and we need to talk about how to do demonstrations. This is probably the most ticklish topic in NLP, and I'll tell you why. Do you want to know why? I took a master practitioner training from some folks who shall remain nameless. And in our master practitioner training in those days, you had to assist at a practitioner training to go through the master practitioner. So we not only went to all of our master practitioner classes, but we also went through all of the practitioner classes again, observing as and a coaching assistant as a master practitioner. And during that training, every single demonstration from the front of the room failed. So not only was there not any success, we had actually 100% failure rate. No, it was bizarre. In fact, I remember a fellow named Hal, bless his heart. Hal was a beautiful man. I loved him. And Hal got up and he said, I'd like to demonstrate the six-step reframe. And a woman raised her hand. Of course, this will happen always. You need to, we'll talk about this again and again, but you need to choose who the demonstration subject is, not the volunteers and not the audience. Be very careful of someone when the group goes like this.
Pointing to somebody.
Bill, they go like this. Choose Bill.
And they're pointing to Bill, and Bill goes, no.
You need to, and Bill goes, choose Bill. Bill will punish you if you choose Bill. Anyway, this woman raises her hand, and Hal's up front. Here's a master practitioner, or going through the master practitioner class, doing a demo of six-step reframe. And Hal says, can I be a volunteer? So she raises her hand right away. He goes, okay, what do you got? And she goes, I have a phobia. And Hal says, great. I guess that'd be okay. Come on up.
Ooh.
And he goes like this. He says, okay, well, I'd like to talk to the part of you that's in charge of the phobia. And the woman started shaking uncontrollably.
She associated into the part, obviously.
She immediately dropped into the phobia, associated totally, and shook for the next half hour. At which point, Hal said, I don't know what to do. And they stopped the demo. By the way, a six-step reframe is not the intervention for a phobia. Do you guys get that? I mean, you're trainers. You know how to think about this. You wouldn't even do a parts integration for a phobia, would you? God, I hope not. I want to talk to the part that's in charge of the phobia.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
So here we get to the first rules.
The woman is shaking, and she shook for 3 more hours.
Good demonstration.
Yeah, great demonstration. Meanwhile, the class is like this. They look at the trainer. And I'm just sitting in the back of the room. I'm a master practitioner. They're looking at the trainer going, why doesn't the main trainer do something? Oh, by the way, if somebody drops into something, they'll expect you to solve the problem. If you don't solve the problem, they will hate you.
Mm-hmm.
I promise. It's like, why didn't he do something? I mean, even if Hal couldn't handle it, why couldn't the main trainer handle it? And the main trainer's going on like nothing happened, you know? Oh, well. And she's like,
Shaking.
Oh, shaking. And she shook for 3 hours. And finally, I walked up to the main trainer. I said, look, this kind of sucks. Can I help her out? He says, yeah. Oh, he says, yeah. Anything you could do would be great. So I took her over in a corner. We did timeline therapy. She came back in 10 minutes with no phobia. And he said, what did you do? I said, oh, just a little timeline stuff I've been playing with.
So that's the first rule of how to do good demonstrations. You always have to demonstrate what you're demonstrating.
Not what you're not demonstrating. Can you imagine that? The first rule of smart demonstrations is to demo what you're demoing and do not demo what you're not demoing. Now that may sound like, oh, well, of course. But it's so silly because we have so many people raise their hand during trainings. When you look for a volunteer and it's the wrong person, it's absolutely the wrong person.
We'll get there in a moment. As a trainer, what you need to know, as a trainer, a demonstration can break you or make you. A good demonstration will absolutely make you into a magnificent trainer. A poor demonstration, no matter how much you teach, the rest of your intellectual teaching, doesn't matter how good you are, it will break you. A faulty demo will have faulty results with students. Their belief in the material will be that it doesn't work. It doesn't happen. In the best case scenario, it may happen for others, but not for me. It should happen, but it doesn't. And things like this.
We're going to look at page 719. Anyone who's attended a number of NLP trainings has seen demonstrations succeed and fail. Adriana and I have seen actually demonstrations fail for the biggest names of NLP and hypnosis. I've actually seen major names in NLP, people whose names you would know, not succeed. I actually saw Richard Bandler not succeed at a swish pattern because I felt he chose the wrong client. I've seen Steve Andreas stop a pattern in the middle of the pattern and say, this just isn't the right pattern for this. This isn't the right person for this demonstration.
Which is better than, you know, go on.
By the way, no offense, I failed at demos too. Yeah. I want you to know that I've had demos that didn't succeed. But every time I didn't succeed with a demo, I stopped and took a look at it and tried to figure out what in the world was it that caused this demo not to succeed. And today, you virtually will not, you'll not see, as least as far as I'm concerned, any. Oh, by the way, all my demonstrations are real.
Thank you. I'm clear on demos.
They're all of my demonstrations are real, and I'm really clear that to fake a demo, if it gets out, is maybe the worst thing you can do. And you know there are trainers who teach trainers trainings here in Australia who fake their demos. No offense.
The problem with that, you see, that ultimately you'll find out. I mean, people will find out. And when they found out, their belief, again, this is where it goes to.
How do you feel?
Their
you see
beliefs in NLP will be that it doesn't work.
You see a totally brilliant demonstration. The client looks like they're totally transformed. And then you hear a month later that it was a faked demo. How do you feel? You go, cheated and ripped off.
Yeah. Exactly.
So if you're careful with your demo selection, you'll succeed. Careful with your demo selection, you'll succeed. Yes. It's possible that the students will end up with subjects that shouldn't be demoed. Yes, it is. It is. So I want to say, it is possible that a student will pick a student and the student himself or herself will use the wrong subject matter. However, if you have good coaching assistants or if you have good feedback from your students, you'll catch it. You'll catch it because you'll say, was there anybody for whom this didn't work? They'll raise their hand. And they'll say, you know, you'll say, so what was it? For example, mapping across. Oh, let's take chaining anchors. Chaining anchors is not for chaining behaviors. It's not for behaviors. It's for states. So I've had people try to do chaining anchors, or better one, collapse anchors. I've had people collapse behaviors. Like collapse anchors. And they raise their hand and they go like this and you go, so what is it? And the client, the potential client says, well, I don't clean up my office.
My office is a mess.
Can we do collapse anchors on my office is a mess?
Now, my office is a mess is not even a behavior. It's a lack of a behavior.
Do you get that? As a trainer, you need to know how to think about this. My office is a mess is not only not a state.
It's not even a behavior.
It's not even a behavior because it's the lack of a behavior. You can't even do a swish pattern on a lack of a behavior. Because the swish pattern is not, person, what the person is doing is, they're not cleaning up the office. But you can't get an effective trigger from a not. There's nothing there for the trigger. Does that make sense? All of this is learning how to think about NLP you've got to think about every pattern you're demonstrating and make sure you got the right person for the demo. I think at least 1 to 2 segments before you need the volunteer, look for the right person.
You start to look.
Start looking
in the audience for the right person. So there is what we call the right demo subject selection, which in the NLP terminology we call pre-qualifying. So you need to pre-qualify the demo subject, and pre-qualification happens before each demonstration. A subject that may be perfect for a demonstration implying submodalities may not be the right subject for a demonstration implying accessing states like anchoring.
Yeah. I mean, some people don't go into states real well. So you get a client. Now, here's another example. So you're asking for a client to do mapping across or collapsing anchors, for example. But let's say, or actually, you're looking for a client for collapsing anchors, but you have a client who never goes into state. That's going to be a demonstration that doesn't succeed. It's going to be a demonstration that doesn't succeed. The trainer should always choose. I think, yeah. So as I said before, don't let the audience choose. Don't let individual members push you. Because a lot of times people, I've seen people who come to the training to get their agenda out of the way, which might, and their agenda might be to punish the trainer. Their agenda might be to punish the trainer.
Or imagine there is somebody who actually doesn't want to let go of a negative state.
For secondary gain or some other reason.
Change of behavior. Once I picked up, the only time I didn't respect this rule was when I did a presentation on NLP and I picked up a demonstration subject just because he was a Romanian lady and she was coming from Romania. So I felt for her and I picked her up as a demo subject. I forgot just one thing, that she didn't want to be the demo subject. So I invited her on stage and she complied, but she didn't want to let go of that.
So
I had a failed demo, and imagine how many people I rolled over in my practitioner.
Zero.
Because if you do a demo in an introductory evening,
it better wildly succeed.
And it doesn't succeed, you can stop the evening right then and there.
Yeah, you might as well pack up your crap and go home. For all the effect that it's done. No, I'm serious.
Yep.
I'm serious. So, rule of thumb, don't take the first volunteer. Ask questions to find out context as well as other vital information about what the client wants to solve. And pick the most appropriate person. Now, some questions you could ask, you'll have to write these down. Some questions you could ask. The question you want to ask, I think, in general, the big picture question, or at least you want to think about it this way, is whatever the problem is, can the client do it now? While they're sitting in the room, I mean.
Can the client do the problem now?
So whatever the problem is, can they do it now? Then the solution is, you get done with the demo, and you say to the client, can you do it now? This is the big picture. There's going to be other questions too.
Another big picture question is to ask the unconscious mind for congruency. If at the unconscious level, the client's the right to make the change.
This is clear in the timeline therapy training. The question is it all right with the unconscious mind for you to make this change today and for you to be aware of it consciously? Those are two important questions. So can you do it now? And is it all right with the unconscious mind for you to get rid of this problem today and for you to be aware consciously of it disappearing? Think of a really successful demo as having a good before and after contrast. A successful demo will not only include the person doing it now, congruent about letting it go, but will also include a good before and after contrast. What does the before and after contrast need to be? What does the before and after contrast need to be? It depends on the pattern, But you need to look at the pattern and see what would the person, if I get rid of this problem for this person, what kind of change can I expect? You want the biggest change from the person, not, you don't want the person who's the most needy in the training. Oftentimes the person in the training who's the most needy does not end up being a real good demonstration subject because they have other secondary gain issues going on. Okay. So, you want to pick the most appropriate person. You'll need to know several things. One, you'll need to know, is the person suggestible? For example, do they go into trance when you suggest it? This is back again on page 719.
Now, if the person is suggestible for trance, the question is, does the person do what you suggest? Because they may be very suggestible. However, Wayne, they may not follow your instructions.
Yeah, there are people who are very suggestible. Here's how you tell. One of the things you could say is...
And by the way, this is very important, so you may want to write this down.
As I raise my hands, what I'd like you to do is take a long, deep breath in. And then go ahead and close the eyes. Now, look up for just a second. If the person, you say, take a long, deep breath in, if the person goes like this...
Close their eyes already.
That's the wrong person for the demo.
They precede your instruction.
You want a person who follows instructions, not a person who precedes instruction. A person who precedes instruction is internally referenced and may not follow your suggestions. There are people who are good hypnotic subjects who are not good demo subjects. You could find a person who mismatches a specific suggestion, like in a moment you'll find yourself swaying back and forth. And they could even mismatch it at the unconscious level. So what you're looking for is compliance, and you're looking for, the next thing is, do they follow your verbal suggestions?
Or do they follow your nonverbal suggestions?
Nonverbal suggestions are on page 720. If they follow one of the above two, is there one they don't follow? These are all considerations in choosing a demonstration subject. Here are some tests you can use. These tests are easy to follow, and they're easy to add to your normal routine in the training. First of all,
do a yes set. Notice how far they follow. Calibrate for their literal response. Yes set goes like this. So you all took time off from your work to be here in this trainer's training.
You took time off to be here, didn't you?
And this is an effort. And this morning you woke up and again you thought, oh, this is a new day of training. Maybe you prepared something in the morning, maybe you didn't, but or you made whatever you could possible to be here now.
But you got here at 1 o'clock.
And you're all doing the best you can to go through all the exercises and you're paying attention to everything we say.
Now, you look for the compliance on the third one because it was, we were pacing current experience, then we did a lead, which is you're paying attention to what we say. Someone who's not paying attention to what we say will not be nodding yes at that point. It's actually quite simple. So do a yes set, notice how far they follow, calibrate for their literal response. Here, next one. Look up for a second. In a moment, we're going to clasp our hands together. Okay, go ahead. Yeah? It's a matter of timing. What I did was raise my hands, hold them apart. I say, in a moment, we're going to clasp our hands together. But hold your hands there longer than usual. And then wait to see if people actually go ahead and clasp their hands together. If they do, don't pick them as demonstration subjects. Then clasp your hands together and notice who follows the nonverbal suggestion. That way you've got both verbal and nonverbal. Pay attention to the people who seem most attentive and follow your suggestions. By the way, you might want to write this down. Just take a pen, yeah? Pay attention to people who are most attentive and say to them, and you might want to write this down, and you take out your pen. And see who follows you. See who follows you. S-E-E. Okay. Okay, so that's a prerequisite. Here's a couple of other prerequisites to demos.
Page 721.
And then we'll actually get to the actual demo thing. So now you have the subject in front of the room. How do you make sure the demonstration goes well?
Keep them happy. Keep them laughing. Demo subjects will find it hard to maintain a negative state if you're funny, and you have them anchored to laughter. A suggestion or two will go a long way. When we do therapy, what we always do with our clients, we keep them happy, we keep them laughing. They had it hard enough being serious about their problem for as long as they did. So now, if you can make your demo subject laugh at their own problem, the problem's half solved already.
So keep them laughing. They'll find it hard to maintain a negative state if you're funny. So use laughter in the process of doing a demo. If you're not good at comedy, study someone who you like at comedy and figure out how they do it. Figure out how they do it. You've got NLP modeling techniques. It's very simple. Yeah? Okay. Number two, covertly anchor the subject. Richard Bandler always anchors the subject covertly behind the back where the audience can't see. So he's talking to the client laughing. He's got his hand back here. And what he's doing is what's the most effective state for anchoring? Naturally occurring states. When a naturally occurring state of laughter occurs, he will anchor them. Now, it's very easy to put your hand on the back of the chair. So let's say this is the back of the chair. It's very easy to put your hand on the back of the chair because you can get the anchor the same every single time as long as the client doesn't move. You get the anchor right in the same place. So simply put your hand on the back of the chair and covertly anchor the subject behind the back. It looks very normal. It looks like it looks like you're just touching the subject. Or if you reach over and go, yeah, like that, you're still anchoring the subject. That's especially true of naturally occurring states. Yep. In a training situation, I don't think you do. If they're going to come up and be a volunteer, I don't think so. Probably, if you don't do it this way, if you do it here, the demo subject is going to be so nervous about being in the front of the room, chances are they won't even notice that they were anchored behind.
Now, we're going to talk about that specifically when we get to how to demonstrate basic anchoring. When you go through the script says, in a moment I will demonstrate a process called anchoring, and that will necessitate that I touch you. Is that all right? So you go through that because you go through the whole script. However, covertly at the back, you can touch them if they are into a positive laughter, happy state. You anchor them at the back, but for that, you don't ask for permission.
Interrupt the pattern.
As you do the elicitation of the problem, interrupt the negative pattern as many times as you can. If you aren't familiar with the logical levels of therapy, this is mastered.
They're in the Master Practitioner NLP tapes, and they're also in the Timeline Therapy tapes.
You need to learn it.
This pattern is vital to successful demos, even if you don't show the students what you're doing. It's especially, especially important. And always be reframing.
So in addition to the logical levels of therapy, don't ever do a demo without reframing the subject. Always. Reframing is very important before you do the demo to loosen up the subject model of the world. Remember, when the subject comes, they have a solid grip on the problem. And so if you're attempting to do a therapeutical intervention while the client has a solid grip on the problem, the intervention may take a long time and it may or may not succeed. However, if you do a process of loosening up first, the problem will disappear very easily.
Here's the rule of thumb. Only do a demo after the client's model of the world with regard to the presenting problem has really, really, really been loosened up. That's not to say it won't succeed if you don't. It is to say that you need to make sure it's really, really, really loose. Okay, so page 726. So, let's go back to, yes. Logical levels of therapy is the question is how do you make sure the client's problem is really loose? Logical levels of therapy is the way to do that. It's in your master practitioner training. Yeah, what you want to do is you want to loosen up the client's model world by reframing or logical levels of therapy or something that changes the client's internal representation about the presenting problem sufficiently so that it's not the client doesn't have a really firm grip on it by the time you start doing the demonstration. Beyond that, it's logical levels of therapy. That's the basic tool. Even if and by the way, you don't teach logical levels of therapy in the practitioner training. To me, that would be the wrong thing to do. Just do it. Yes. For example, in the phobia.
When you move the kinesthetic and you move the feeling from one place to...
That's not a rule, by the way. That's just an example.
Somewhere else, okay.
Yeah, you move the... What you're doing when you do that is you're scrambling the client's strategy. Logical levels of therapy scrambles the client's strategy by changing the submodalities of each step of the strategy. So when you move the kinesthetic from here down into the big toe, that scrambles the kinesthetic portion of the strategy. One of the ways to loosen the client's model of the world is to scramble the strategy. Another way is to reframe.
So are you asking when do you know? How do you know that the client's model of the world has been loosened?
It's a little 2-6 for me, Liz. Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So the question is, how would you know that the client's ready and the client's model of the world is loose now, loosened?
In logical levels of therapy, you would know that it was loose enough when the client could no longer run the strategy that caused the phobia.
But you're concentrating on a single event or a single demonstration on a phobia. But this is something that you will do before each demonstration. Yeah, before.
Before every demonstration.
Not only
before
phobia.
You need to loosen up the client's model of the world. Whether you do reframing, whether you do logical levels of therapy, whether you do submodality shift, whether you deliberately misunderstand the client. Right before we did the phobia. Right before we did the phobia. As you were practicing? No.
No, she was on stage already when we did the demo.
She was on the stage. And we screwed with the strategy. Yes. I'll say it again. When she couldn't run the strategy that she used to do the phobia. Can you do it now? Yes. Can you do it now? No. So can you do the phobia now? Yes. Okay, good, stop. Okay, then you do the logical levels of therapy, and then you go, can you do it now? And the client goes, no. Then you do the intervention.
So it's a matter of calibration and congruency. At the very beginning, the client will be extremely congruent. This is the problem,
phobia.
And this is how I do it. And
I've
there's
the
no
phobia,
other way. That's
it.
How I, yeah? That's at the beginning. After you do the reframing and or logical levels of therapy, the client won't be congruent anymore. It'll be, I still have that problem. Yeah.
The client may even begin to talk about the problem as if it was in the past.
Yeah, so you need to pay attention to the client's words as well as you calibrate for physiological signs and shifts. Does that answer your question? Good.
You're making a rule out of it, though. And don't make a rule out of it, because not every demonstration will respond to logical levels of therapy. You may have to do deliberately misunderstand the strategy. You may have to do reframing. You may have to do
pattern interrupt,
something else. I mean, it goes like this. So can you do it now? Oh, by the way, just a second. Before we start, like, let's say Adriana's doing it, yeah? And I'll say, okay, so can you do your problem now? Oh,
yeah,
hold on
yeah.
a second. And one more thing I wanted to say. Before
so here
we do
I am,
this
I'm
demo.
Trying to do it, yeah? And it's immediately.
Yeah, hold on. I'm not interrupting. Hold on a second. So right before we do this demo, what I want you to do is this. Okay, can you do it now?
Yeah.
Oh, wait,
yeah.
wait, hold on. And then by the way, one, and then, oh, can you do it now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hold on, sorry, just one more, I'm sorry, I really forgot to
so
teach
this
it.
Is how you do it, yeah? That's pattern interrupt.
You're interrupting it. You interrupt it three times, the interrupt's going to become part of the pattern. So that's another way to do it, in addition to logical levels of therapy. So you interrupt the pattern as you're about to do it. And you could tell a joke.
And the more serious is the problem, the presenting problem, and the more serious the student is about the problem, the more you have to pay attention to doing all you can to loosen the grip on the problem.
Before you demonstrate the pattern.
I mean, there is a difference between somebody who says, yeah, I like chocolate and I want to let it go. Yeah, I don't want to eat chocolate. I'm fine. Yeah, I'm ready to go. Now, that's a client who's probably ready to do the intervention directly.
Congruent.
And there is a difference between this example and a client who comes and says, yeah, I got lots of anger. I mean, I can't, so many cases, and I'm an angry person, you know.
And you want to let it go? So you want to let it go, and they go.
Well, yeah, I think it would be a good thing.
That's not congruent.
See, that's a client who's absolutely holding tight onto the problem. So that's how you calibrate and you notice the differences. Okay?
That's right. That's exactly right. What the hell are you going to test? So then you say to the client at the very end, a moment ago, you heard me say this. Well, actually, Adriana did all the demonstrations this summer. But anyway, you heard her say. So you came up here a moment ago, you could do this problem. Now you can't do it.
But you did all the time on therapy, I think.
What's happened? Oh, yeah, in timeline therapy, I said it. Yeah. So you say, what I say is, so you came up here for 5 minutes and all your anger's gone. How's that possible? Come on, do some anger for me. And they go, I can't. Come on, I don't believe that crap. Do it. Try again. Test it again. And so that gives you the real contrast. But the truth is, especially with the logical levels of therapy, the thing's going to be gone. Yes. If you can get rid of it totally, get rid of it totally. The rule of thumb is if you can get rid of it totally, get rid of it totally, and then do the pattern.
Do the pattern anyway, yeah. They cannot run the
strategy.
Here.
Listen. Here's how it works, yeah? Phobia, yeah? How do you know it's time to do your phobia, yeah? They go, well, can you do it now? They go, yeah, I can do it now. Okay, then you interrupt it, right? Okay, Now we're going to do the timeline therapy for it.
See, all you scrambled is a strategy your timeline, go back into the past. Phobia. However, you didn't let go of the root cause of the phobia.
Yes?
Collapse
anchors, okay. For what? When would they do? When would they do that? You say, well, come on, pick a time when you could do it. You're not going to dislodge collapse anchors as much as you're going to dislodge a phobia. You want to make sure the clients hold on, it's loose. Collapse anchors is already going to be loose. It's not a major kind of thing. Not a major kind of intervention. Yes. You said, does it ever happen? If you ask me any question with the word ever in it in NLP, I would have to say I've done it. You say good, there's nothing there to do. Thanks, give her a hand. Let's have another subject. Yeah, I mean, loosening up the subject's mind, I mean, we're making way too much of this. We've spent now significantly more time on this subject than I ever have in any trainer's training I've done. But
so logical, let's recap. Logical levels of therapy is used only in some cases. Reframing is used almost all the time. Pattern interrupt. So you use them whenever it is appropriate. You won't use every time logical levels of therapy. You won't use every time reframing.
Yeah, Bassam's trying to make a rule out of it, and there's no rule. Yeah, there's no rule per se. You just use whatever seems appropriate to you at the moment, and you do the demo when the client's model of the world is loose. Is there a danger of blowing it out? There's never a danger of blowing out a problem. And you may do it sometimes, but there's never a danger. Yeah. Yeah.
So now we're going to go through each and every pattern. We talk about them, and then you're going to understand what applies to each of them. Yeah? Before we go into each pattern, though,
the first thing.
When you demonstrate them, you need to respect the script.
Ooh, can we go back just 1 second?
Sure.
As you're picking the demonstration subject, make sure you ask the demonstration subject some questions, which will tell you whether or not that subject will be a good demonstration subject. We said that, but I want to say it again. Okay, now you're doing the demo. Make sure you respect the script.
As possible, as close as you can, respect it word for word. Now, there is something else. You are an NLP trainer. You know how to do demos. And if you are too shiny, if you show off too much, then your students will think, oh, my God, I could never do such a thing.
This is a problem.
This is way beyond me. I couldn't possibly be so good.
There are some trainers in NLP who would like you to think you can't do it as well as they can.
However, your intention is to inspire your students to know that they can do whatever you do.
Not to disempower them.
You need to be very precise. You need to be as good as you can be. But this is why you need to stick to the script as close as you can. Because if you just read the script and
they
you succeed with the demo, the students will go, all I need to do is to read the script and my demo will succeed. My exercise will succeed. And this is very empowering for them.
If you substantially deviate from the script, your students will be subtly disempowered because they will think they have to know as much as you do to be able to do that. However, if you stick with the script, then they will stick with the script and they'll get magnificent results.
At the practitioner level, you need to remember that usually students are creative and they don't know that they need to respect the script anyway. And they'll try to add balloons here and there and bring angels to the
especially if they're
therapeutical process.
Hypnotherapists are very
do stories and metaphors and everything else. Yeah. I didn't say that.
Richard's going, oh my God. No offense, but hypnotherapists are very creative in many ways, and they think they'll need to throw a whole bunch of stuff in. The closer you stick with the script. So,
I saw people who did Tai Chi, and they're trying to bring energy in the thing. And people are trying to bring in whatever their life experience is to make a success out of the therapy. They think that that is necessary. However, all they need to do is to respect the script, have a clear, defined problem, and they'll succeed. That's what you need to inspire them.
Now, precision about the demo. The more precise you can be about the demo, that is to say, the closer you stick to the script, the better the results will be for the students. If you don't like the scripts that you got when you purchased our manuals, then rewrite them. I'm not stuck on any script, but the key is to stick as close to the script that you give them. Because sticking to that script is going to give them the power to do it the same way you did it and theoretically get the same results. Okay.
Now, the demonstrations should create a feeling of, I want that. I want to be able to do that in your students.
If it creates that, then what? The students will want the pattern.
They'll have a positive, significant emotional experience. They'll want the pattern, they want to use the pattern, and they, as I said before, will install automatically the belief that the pattern works for them and others.
If you don't install that when you do a demo, then why did you do the demo? Do you know what I mean? If you don't install, wow, I want that, then the question is, why do the demo? You with me? Yeah.
As you demonstrate a pattern, you need to also closely pay attention to the time necessary for you to get the problem, to resolve the problem. Because if it will take you 20 minutes for a swish pattern, it will take your students 40 minutes for a swish pattern. And you know the swish pattern with finding the trigger and everything else from the beginning to the end probably is no longer than 10 minutes.
You can do it in 5.
I said 10 minutes.
Quicker, the quicker the better.
Yeah.
Yeah, the quicker the better.
Including pre-qualifying.
Oh, yeah, definitely pre-qualifying. So the amount of time that the students think it will take to do the pattern will depend on how your demo went. So as I said, some patterns should be demoed, some should not. And I think that's important. If you're really good at demos and it would create a dissonance between the students and you as to the pattern success, like if a student looks at you and sees you do a demo and they go, oh my God, I could never do that, then that's not a good thing to have demoed. Because what you're doing is you're subtly disempowering them. Yeah? So, if on the other hand, you give them a script, and by the way, you should never do a demo without teaching in your trainings. You should never do a demo without teaching the pattern first in the how section. So you go, step one is, this is step two, this is step three, this is step four, this is step five. You go through that before you do the demo.
Basically, you read with them the page which describes how to do the demo.
And you read it with them, which gives them a context in which to hold what they're seeing.
Now they're looking at you, they see you doing the demo, but they know, oh, now he's doing a VAK association on each part. Now he's chunking up the first part. Now he's chunking up the second part. Now there are the steps where 5 A, B, and C.
And you've heard me say in some demos, you've actually heard me say, okay, now we're at step number 6. That's so the students know exactly where we are in the process of the demo. Now, when you do your demos during this training, you don't have to be that precise and you don't have to teach the pattern beforehand. But when you do a training, you should definitely be that precise as to what you're doing, step by step by step by step. Good. Okay, let's go through the patterns. We're on page 726. Okay. Okay. Let's get this out too while we're at it. This is our thing here. So, first exercise, sensory acuity exercise. Basic demonstration is someone you like and someone you don't like. Now, you bring the person to the front of the room and you have the audience notice the difference between the person that they liked and the person they disliked.
Now, let's see, how do you do pre-qualifying for this basic demonstration? What's necessary in a demonstration subject for your students to notice clearly the difference? Remember, again, you're at the beginning of the practitioner.
And very
beginning
of
practice. Your students
do
not have calibration and sensory acuity.
They don't have the sensory acuity you do, for sure.
So what's necessary? Someone who's expressive externally, and also especially someone whose
yes.
physiological shifts are very, very different from a person they like to somebody they dislike. And so in the pre-qualifying section, you say, I will need a volunteer. I will do a demonstration and sensory acuity. So who here has somebody they really, really like? And you have them.
You have to raise your hand.
And you, while they raise their hand, you notice.
You calibrate.
You calibrate.
Yeah, and
okay,
then you say,
well,
who here has
you.
Someone you really, really dislike? And you have them raise their hand again.
And you notice people who go like this for the first one, and they light up, and they smile, and they are. Their eyes are bright, and you're
good
looking
subject.
for absolute signs, very easy to calibrate.
Good subject. So if they sit there like this, can you think of someone you like, and who has someone they like, and the person goes like this?
And there's absolutely no shift.
And then you say, think of someone you dislike, who has someone they dislike?
And again, no shift.
No shift. That's not the person to pick. So pre-qualify them while they're sitting in their chairs. Who has someone they like? Who has someone they dislike? You look at them. You see what you can see from how far away you are to them, because that's how far your students will be from them. Then you bring the person up in front of the room and you ask them those questions. Remember, the students are farther away and their student's sensory acuity will be significantly less than yours. So whenever you pick someone against whom you're calibrating, you need to pick someone who lights up dramatically. That's the rule of thumb about calibration, is the students won't have the capabilities you do.
Remember, the success of this demonstration is for the demo subject to pick somebody they really, really like versus somebody they really dislike.
Now, if somebody raises their hand and says, I'd like to volunteer, but I don't have anybody I really dislike, don't pick that person. I mean, I know that sounds, you know, well, gosh, Dad, that's like overly redundant, but the truth is that this is what you have to think about. Because I've seen people pick, well, you come on up anyway, even if you don't have somebody you totally dislike, come up anyway and we'll do it. And then you don't get the widely separated, you know, physiology between the two. Okay. Next is rapport. What kind of rapport? I think there's not much to demonstrate in rapport, except I think it is important that the student is capable of knowing the difference between matching and mirroring. And I think the student also needs to know how to do crossover mirroring. The quickest way is to demo it. So here's how you demo the difference between matching and mirroring. Bassam, put up your right hand, please. Good. Now I'm matching. Yeah, and now I'm mirroring. So Bassam puts up his right hand. I put up my right hand, and I say, now I'm matching. And the students can see it immediately. And then you say, now I'm mirroring. And then you put up your left hand, which becomes a mirror image. Thank you. So that's the quickest way to do it. Oh, by the way, this is not one of the demos on demo day. Much too easy. There's no demo on demo day for rapport. Okay, crossover, mirroring. You can talk about an experience you had where you did crossover mirroring. There's a videotape of Erickson doing, you can quote Erickson if you don't have a lot of experience of doing crossover mirroring yourself. You can quote Erickson. There's a videotape where Erickson did this with his finger to pace someone else's breathing. I've actually seen it, so you can say there's a videotape. Yeah. If you don't have any experience yourself, if you have an experience yourself of doing crossover mirroring, then talk about your experience and how it worked. Yeah. Okay.
Eye patterns. Now, it's written here in your manual 7.26, students have to be told this is only for others, not for self. However, now we say more than this. Students have to be told this is a normally organized right-handed person as you look at them.
Oh, yeah, you got to say that.
So this is the chart for a normally organized right-handed person as you look at them.
You can draw the chart if you got the slides. I think it says that already on the eye pattern chart, normally organized right-handed as you look at them. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be some right-handed people who are reverse organized.
Yep.
And that doesn't mean there can't be some left-handed people who are normally organized.
This is why you have to say it this way.
You have to say it. Yeah. And students are told that the eye patterns are for self only. Sorry, for others only, not for self. The purpose of eye patterns is to detect them and to use predicates to match them. Look up for a second, please. When you're teaching eye patterns, you don't do this. Visual construct.
You don't point with your arm.
Because where are they looking? Students go like this. What's up there? So what you do is you move your eyes into visual construct. So what you say is visual construct. Now that requires that you're going to have to learn the eye patterns for yourself. Don't have your students learn them for self.
In fact, tell them.
Tell them not to.
That's only for others.
Tell them you need to learn eye patterns only for others. Now, why do we have you learn it for self? Because you've got to demonstrate the eye patterns with your eyes.
Even if you are reversely organized, you have to demonstrate normally organized right-handed.
If you're reverse organized, do not tell your students, don't look at my eye patterns, I'm reverse organized. What does that do?
Lots of confusion, yeah?
It'll totally, they'll go, reverse. They got nothing to hold it in. So you have to learn the eye patterns. Now you have to learn the eye patterns. Visual construct, visual recall, kinesthetic. Here's the easiest way to remember the eye patterns for yourself as a trainer. A good upright citizen is someone who goes along making it up as he goes. And kinesthetic is downright feeling. That's the easiest way to remember it. The rest of it you can work out from there. That's the
also,
easiest way
C
to remember.
C is before R.
Yeah. Yes. I actually overemphasize it. So you could say, so the person with an individual construct. And really overemphasize it. Yeah. Or I talk a lot about when I went to Washington, D.C. and worked with the Bureau of Indian Affairs people. I said, and the guy went like this. I don't know. I just did.
So, visual construct, visual recall, auditory, digital, kinesthetic. Yeah.
VCVRADK. And I asked him again, so how did you decide to take this job? And he goes, I don't know.
And his eyes moved again.
I just did.
Visual construct, visual recall, auditory, digital, kinesthetic.
You got to make sure you get the strategy right that you describe. But as a trainer, it's now time for you to learn how to demonstrate the eye patterns.
For that, in the pre-qualifying section, you need a normally organized person. So you're going to ask, who here thinks that they're normally organized?
The easiest way to pre-qualify somebody in eye patterns is, who here thinks that they're normally organized? And then they'll raise their hand. Yeah. Then you say, what did you do yesterday? See if they go to visual recall. So, question you probably ought to write it down on page 726. The question is, what did you do yesterday? And then the first question, which is, who here thinks they're normally organized? And that, you know why that's so good? It's so good because if you get somebody up who's reversed organized, what do? You tell them, sit down. And then people won't get upset. I used to not say who here thinks you're normally organized, and somebody come up and they were reverse organized, and I'm sending them back down, and people go, boy, Tad's such a bastard. Why did he send that person back down? And you can even go so far as to explain, we really want somebody who's normally organized for this demo. Because you want the students to see what they're seeing, not what, and you can't say this person reverse organized, so imagine everything's the opposite. Because the students don't even know the eye patterns yet. So you can't say it. You can't have them. Don't worry about it. This person's just reverse organized. So now imagine the opposite of what you're seeing on the slide here. Just make it the opposite. And the people are going, what? So dumb. No, I mean, these may sound like little things, but this is the difference between having a really successful set of demos and a bunch of bogus demos. And I've seen them done both ways. I promise. Okay.
So pick somebody who's normally organized, preferable with big eyes.
Big eyes.
So your students can see easily. And
no glasses.
No glasses.
No rimmed glasses. No glasses. If they have big eyes, tell them to take, and they're willing to do it, have them take their glasses off for the demo. Now, the problem with doing that is, if you pick someone with glasses, have them take their glasses off for the demo, the problem with doing that is, then somebody's bound to raise their hand and go like this, but I couldn't ask somebody to take their glasses off in a business context. Yeah, and what you have to say is, well, yes, of course not. We're just doing it for the purposes of this demo, but you've already lost that round. So best to pick somebody with big eyes, clear patterns, and no glasses.
Yes.
If you end up with three students, what do? Where the students don't conform to the requirements of the patterns, you just do the best you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
If
everybody's reverse organized, I'd be surprised.
Please add in the pre-qualifying section another question which you can ask. While you spotted the person who's normally organized and has big eyes, no glasses, Is there any trauma in your past?
Good question.
Because if a person had a lot of trauma in their past, they may not have clear, defined eye patterns. They may not access all quadrants.
They may not access kinesthetic, to be specific.
Yeah. When the client's on stage, you will do the eye tracking. But you'd rather have somebody from the beginning who didn't have trauma. So then you have a nice, round, smooth movement of the eyes all around the quadrants. Irrespectively.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, before they come on stage, ask them, is there any trauma in your past? If they say, how serious a trauma, you go, good, who else wants to come on up? I know. Yep, I know. There's traumas with letters everywhere.
Yep.
I heard of somebody that had FLUB the other day. I didn't have any idea what it was. Yes. Yes. You cannot do a demo with eye patterns or strategy elicitation without putting up the eye chart. Whenever you're doing a demo of strategy elicitation or eye patterns, you must have the eye chart on the flip chart or on the slide. Yes. During demo day, you don't know what demo you're going to get. No, you'll have to draw it. You'll have to draw it. Yeah, during a demo day, you'll have to draw the eye pattern chart from memory.
And if somebody gets the eye pattern elicitation and somebody else gets strategy elicitation, the second person will have to draw it again.
The rule of thumb during demo day is if you have anything on the flip chart when you come up, or if there's something on the flip chart when you come up and you start your demo, turn the flip chart over and start again. That's what I would say. Okay. Are you with us on eye patterns? Excellent. Submodalities is next. Submodalities. So,
one of the most important parts in points to remember during any submodalities demonstration is that you have to demonstrate the speed of eliciting submodalities. You will also be required to say to your students that they need to do the exercise faster than the conscious mind can process.
Please say this when you demo submodalities or when you teach it. You want to do this faster than the conscious mind can process. Slightly faster than the conscious mind can process. We had a real interesting situation in a trainer's training in the United States, not this year, but last year.
2 years ago, yeah.
So, show them.
So
Adriana's running the demo day.
And this trainer-to-be demonstrates submodalities elicitation.
And he's very slow. He's like this. He's like this. Where's my pen?
So I'll be the demo subject.
You'll be the subject, yeah. Okay. And by the way, never demo submodalities without having a submodalities checklist in your hand. Yeah? So he goes like this. So pretend I have a submodality out here. I'll pretend this is a submodality checklist. So he goes like this. All right, now that first picture,
yeah,
is it in black and white or color?
Black and white.
Black and white. Is it near or is it far?
It's quite here.
Near. Is it bright or dim?
Bright.
Bright. Good. And what's the location?
Over there on that wall. This is the second picture already.
The wall.
Well, let's cut the whole story short.
It was, I watched this.
To the end, there were three different pictures elicited.
The client had three. This is a client.
Because the client was bored and created
who's at trainer's level. This is a client who's at trainer's level with a trainer who's at trainer level who elicited three different pictures from the client because he didn't move fast enough.
I don't think we have to say that the demonstration didn't succeed.
What?
It was a mapping across.
It was a mapping across. Which one do you map across? I would.
You tell them before you do it and you tell them after.
Tell them before you do it. Tell them after you do it. You tell them before they go into an exercise. You tell them after they come back from exercise.
Our experience as a practitioner is that you cannot tell them enough.
And they don't get it. They think black and white or color is fast.
Some of them are in overload.
Some of them are kinesthetic and proud of.
Where to look first and to write down first and to look at the next question and what to do. And some of them are simply kinesthetic people and they are slower and they feel pressured. So you cannot tell them.
Too much pressure to make me go fast. Kinesthetic and proud of it will give you feedback that you're putting too much pressure on them by making them do submodalities quickly. So, that's right. You tell them, it doesn't matter how much pressure you feel, do it fast.
You explain to them what's happening. You know, the shift takes place at the unconscious level. The unconscious mind works faster than the conscious mind can process. And that's okay. But however, you may get complained.
So, you must demonstrate the speed with which submodalities are elicited, or the class will take a long time to elicit them. Now, I don't care whether you do it quickly with one person, but the very first time you do submodalities, you need to demonstrate that speed. This is one of those things in a training. I'm not saying you may not have to demonstrate contrastive analysis or mapping across if your students get it and they're quick at it, but you will have to demonstrate this is a must. In your own training, you'll have to demonstrate the speed with which submodalities are elicited, or your students will do it way too slowly. So for those of you that didn't train with us, it's this quick. So you want to get a picture?
Yeah.
Black and white or color?
Color.
Near or far?
Over there.
Bright or dim?
Bright.
Is it, and it's over there, yeah?
Yeah.
Is it movie or still?
That's a movie.
Great. It's that fast, yeah? It's that fast.
When you demonstrate that.
Well, I didn't have a list, but. Well, you just write a C. So black and white or color, she says color, you go C.
Good point.
Good question. The submodalities checklist that we gave out, in our trainings, has all of the possible submodalities on it, I think. If there were more submodalities, I'd like to put them on there. So what we do in our training is before we actually have the student elicit the submodalities, we actually have them go down the submodalities checklist and we have them draw a line at a certain point We have them draw a line at a certain point in that submodalities checklist. So where we have them draw the line in the submodalities checklist, let me just see if I can get this for you very, very quickly. Where we have them draw the line in the submodalities checklist is right
under the movie or still, I think.
After. Right after. Yeah, I'm just going to put it on the screen here.
Right.
So, right after movie or still, which is right here. That's movier still. And then we have them draw the line after 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 auditory submodalities and 4 kinesthetic submodalities. So they draw the line under those. We have them draw the line under those, movier still. We have them draw the line under the first 4 auditory
so
and the first 4 kinesthetic.
So under loud or soft and auditory and under intensity.
Yeah.
And kinesthetic. Now, 2 things. When you ask if it's associated or dissociated, especially the level of the practitioner where there is a bit of confusion between what's associated, what's dissociated, ask them, are you looking through your own eyes rather than are you associated?
Are you looking through your own eyes? Before you ever do an exercise, you have to explain. Yes. Before you do an exercise, you have to explain. Before you teach submodalities, before you actually do a submodalities exercise, you have to explain the difference between associated and dissociated. You have to go over the entire list and go through what it is, but you don't have to do that on demo day.
So do you remember how we do it? We show the class the list of submodalities, and then we take a red, thick red pen, and then we draw the line on their movie or
screen. We say, okay, look up everybody,
look
draw
up
the line
everybody.
Here.
Draw the line here.
Draw the line here.
Then
draw
the line under loud or soft on auditory. And now draw another line under intensity and kinesthetic. This is how we do it. Yeah.
And then the students only go down and they elicit right down to the line. Because the rest of the submodalities are probably superfluous for anything that they would be using them for. We have all the submodalities present because that's what we might use in modeling. So this is a multi-purpose sheet that you have in your handout. But in terms of just doing submodalities at the practitioner level, they really only need those down to the line. Okay. Yes. We're going to talk about that We're going to talk about that when we get to contrastive analysis and mapping across, which is next. And we'll do that next.